Don't take it personally.
That everybody, that everybody left.
Honestly, it's probably for the best. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Sydney Tribe here on behalf of the appellant, Nicholas Peters. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. We're here this morning on an appeal from summary judgment in a remarkably undeveloped factual situation in an area of law that has been evolving and is not nearly as clear-cut as the other side would like to suggest. What we have here is a situation where there's a dispute over the insurance policy, first of all, the undefined term accident, whether or not State Farm actually defined the term accident by using the negative method of putting an exculpatory clause in, whether or not there was any intent to injure here as opposed to intent to strike, which is the only undisputed fact in this record.
Objective or subjective intent to injure?
Subjective intent to injure, certainly. I mean, if you look at the development of the case law, if you look at, for example, a case like Detweiler, the
reasonable minds could disagree whether the fragments were going to be a cause of injury.
Right.
Or no reasonable person could have anticipated the ricochet, but
right,
this guy with training could have anticipated. In Hales, on the Onion case, the irrigation case, no evidence that this person knew or should have known that turning on the irrigation would cause rot. In Hammond Rye, knew or should have known that would lead a prudent person to believe there was reasonably foreseeable harm. Aren't all those cases directly linked to an objective standard?
I think they're linked to a standard, well, a reasonable person standard, certainly an objective standard, but at the same time, those cases all have incredibly well-developed facts upon which a reasonable person is basing the decision. So I think whether you consider it to be completely objective or partially subjective on the part of the person who's committing the intentional act, the fact remains that you have to have a sufficiently developed factual record to establish whether or not a reasonable person would conclude that this is, in fact, a situation where nobody could disagree that there was intent to injure. Again, you haven't...
You aren't arguing this is to the absurd, but you're not arguing that a person with a loaded gun pointing at a person who intentionally pulls the trigger can say, I didn't really intend to hurt anybody.
Actually, this court has said that sometimes the use of alcohol can negate an intent to injure. You have, certainly in that situation, if they knew the gun was loaded, for example, say some kids are horsing around and they don't know the gun is loaded, or say they think the gun is loaded with blanks and it's actually not. There's a lot of factual circumstances that can intervene to make what might seem like a black and white situation of intentional, not just action, but intent to injure, suddenly become a lot less clear. And I think that's the modern development of the case law reflects that. And what you have here is the only undisputed fact you have in this record is that he struck him. The plea of...
He formed a fist and intentionally struck his friend.
He said that he said in his statement that he struck him. That's all. He didn't say that it was with a fist. He didn't say that it was with an open hand. He didn't say what the circumstances were. He said, I struck him, but I didn't intend to injure him.
On summary judgment, when there's evidence in the record, though, that the police report has, he formed a fist, his statement to others was he formed a fist, and one at one place hit him 3 times in the face. Can you just say, I struck him with my hand? That's not enough to turn the table in the summary judgment standard, is it?
If the question is whether it's disputed whether he intended to injure him, then yes. It was State Farm's motion. They had the burden of proof. And all they submitted was, again, they did submit their police report, but he didn't admit to any of the facts in the police report in his guilty plea. All he said was, I intentionally assaulted another person. And under this court's jurisprudence in State v. Osman, all that is an admission that he intended to touch him. He did not. It does not include an intent to injure. So again, if the burden is on State Farm, And again, they don't bring any witnesses. They don't have any declarations. They don't depose Mr. Belt. All they do is submit this police report and say, here, he intentionally struck him. Therefore, it's automatically an intent to injure, and we're all done. And they come back, we come back on in response on summary judgment and say, well, wait a minute, he didn't intend to injure him. And then there is a dispute of material fact. Intent is disputed, intent to injure, and therefore summary judgment was inappropriate.
Apart from Queen City, do you have any cases that you rely on for the proposition that there's a subjective component where subjectivity alone can generate a question of fact?
I certainly think that, I mean, all of the cases you just ran through, I realize that they talk about a reasonable person standard, et cetera, but they're so fact-intensive. You know, certainly in Detweiler, there is, I mean, it may not be as explicit as we all would like, but there's certainly a suggestion that it's a question of whether or not he perceived that he was actually going to, they talk about, for example, that he shot at the tires. So it's not a sort of blank slate, you know, gun, reasonable person. They're all incredibly fact-intensive injuries. But honestly, Your Honor, whether it's an objective standard or a subjective standard, it's still, the facts are disputed here. It is a reasonable person, again, because we don't know all of the circumstances, because the factual record wasn't sufficiently developed. This case was not ready for summary judgment, and the proper decision.
Was that argument made?
Well, yeah, the argument was made in response to summary judgment that they had not demonstrated that there was no dispute of material fact.
Well, was there a motion to continue under CR 50?
I will have to double-check the record. I believe there was, Your Honor, but, again, the question is.
Well, you don't talk about that in your brief.
Well, State Farm had the burden. Well, so to ask for a continuance for the plaintiff to continue to develop the record when it's State Farm's burden to develop the record.
Well, it's State Farm's burden on summary judgment to submit evidence that shows there's no material issue of fact. Having done that, the burden shifts. So when the burden shifted, then you are responsible, your client is responsible for submitting evidence to show there's material issue of fact.
Right, and the burden was met by submitting a declaration on a material question of material.
So it's not that it wasn't developed, it's that you submitted that declaration, and that's what we should focus on.
Yes, exactly, because the question is, State Farm's position was, as soon as he admitted that he intended to strike Mr. Peters, then that's it, the case is over. There's no other inquiry.
Well, they can do that in their moving motion.
Yes.
I mean, that's they can take that position.
Yes, they certainly can. And then when in response a declaration, a sworn declaration is submitted saying I did not intend to injure, and that's an element of the question of whether there's a disputed issue of material fact, then it's their burden to come back and say, well, there was intent to injure and there's no dispute of material fact that there was intent to injure. And that's not what happened here. The case was simply dismissed. And that is our argument as to why that was incorrect. And that it was State Farm's burden, once Mr. Peters had met his burden, then it was State Farm's burden to come back.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Rogers for State Farm. Peters did move for a continuance. They were granted a continuance of 60 or 90 days. They wanted to take some depositions. They did not take the depositions. The summary judgment proceeded.
Do you get the benefit of the police report simply by attaching it with your motion? The facts alleged in the police report?
We attached it. Well, first of all, it was a certified copy. What we attached was the guilty plea and conviction. And he said, this is CP 94, I plead guilty to the crimes of count one, fourth degree assault as charged in this complaint or citation. I have received a copy of that complaint or citation. So he did admit to the facts in the complaint. The complaint included the police report. In the police report, it says Belt then became really angry and he made a fist and punched Peters on the right side of his jaw, causing Peters to fall to the ground.
Where's the three times come from? Is that in the, I thought that was in the police report.
It says jaw was fractured in three places. I don't remember three times, Your Honor.
Yeah.
On summary judgment, we have the burden to show the absence of a genuine issue of material fact. And we can file our motion, and they have the burden to show a material fact. They cannot rely on conclusory statements in affidavits. They have to rely on facts. And his conclusory statement that he didn't intend to injure somebody when he punched them in the jaw is not something you can consider without facts to support it. And they have no facts.
Well, they have his subjective intent. That's the argument.
Right. And the test is an objective one. Under over 60 years of case law, it's an objective test under the meaning of the term accident. And Belt testified he intentionally struck Peters in the face. He broke Peters' jaw. And no average purchaser of insurance, no reasonable person would think that intentionally striking somebody in the face is an accident. And no average purchaser of insurance would think that you buy insurance to protect you when you punch somebody in the face. Hitting somebody in the face is not analogous, as they said in the brief, to turning in front of somebody, turning right in front of somebody and causing a car accident. It's analogous to intentionally ramming somebody, like in the Roller versus Stonewall case. That is simply not an accident. And if you look at the case law, the case that's most close to this one is the Safeco versus Dots case, where the insured backhanded someone sitting on his girlfriend's bed, and he later collapsed into a coma and died. And they said that that was not an unexpected or unusual result from the standpoint of a reasonable person. We don't have nearly so extreme facts here. Here he punched somebody in the jaw, and the jaw broke. You've all heard the phrase glass jaw. I mean, it's everybody knows that if you punch somebody in the face, you can break their jaw.
Why, when you follow the roller coaster of the twists and turns of the development of the case law of what's an accident, homeowners, or general liability policies, why would the insurance companies not take advantage of the chance to add clarity by including an express definition of what an accident is? Doesn't it suggest that there's a benefit to the myriad case law articulations of what that means? And
Your Honor, I had a case years ago where the insurance company used the phrase resident of the insured's household was defined in the case law. And the insurance company decided to use easy reading language, living with, and it did not turn out the way they expected. We have over 60 years of case law saying that the word accident is not ambiguous. And we have over millions and millions of policies approved by the insurance commissioner with that term. We all know what it means. The average purchaser of insurance knows what the meaning of accident is. In their reply brief, they say...
So is your position that any attempt to define it would create problems?
I'm saying that it could, depending on how you define it. And there are cases where they define it, and we've seen them in the Queen City Farms case, for example, or the Wu case, where they define it using a subjective standard, and you can do that. But the average purchaser of insurance would use an objective standard. An accident, as they say in Roller versus Stonewall, an accident is an accident or it is not. We know what it is. When you hit somebody in the face, it's not an accident.
It could be. It could be an intentional swing, but not deliberate, because the person you're swinging at ducks and you connect with the person behind them. It's intentional, but it's not deliberate.
Do we have those facts here? We don't. You can shoot a gun thinking that there's blanks in it too, but we don't have facts like that here. I mean, he admits he intentionally hit Mr. Peters in the face, and when you do that, it's not unusual or unexpected that you could injure somebody by breaking their jaw.
Why shouldn't we look at the exclusion to define by implication what the policy means for purposes of accident?
Well, as they state in their opening brief, insurance coverage is a two-step process. First, the insurance company has the burden to show, or the insured has the burden to show that a loss is within the scope of the insured losses. Then, if it is, then the insurance company has the burden to show that it's excluded. So we have two separate parts of the policy. We have structure in the policy. And here, to be an insured loss, it has to be an accident. If there is an accident, then you go to the exclusions and apply them. They're asking you to use an exclusion to define the term accident that doesn't even use that term. Accident is not found in it. It's not a provision that's in the definition section of the policy. It doesn't purport to define accident. And we have a number of cases that we've cited in our brief where you had policies with the accident term in the grant of coverage. And you have the exclusions, just like this one, and they interpret them separately. The Hall versus State Farm case that I tried, the jury was instructed separately on those two provisions. so there's no reason, there's no basis for saying that a provision that doesn't purport to use the term accident defines the term accident. They talk about public policy. No public policy requires insurance companies to cover assaults. And no public policy requires insurance companies to define the term accident.
What difference does it make whether we look at the exclusionary provision at a practical level? Because the exclusion included either bodily injury is excluded if either expected or intended. Isn't expected or intended implicit in the common law statements?
Expected or intended under the common law is given a subjective standard. Under the Queen City Farms, the Wu case, under a number of cases, when the policy uses the words expected or intended, it's given a subjective test. But if you're just using the word accident, it's given an objective test from the standpoint of a reasonable person.
This exclusion doesn't really say from the standpoint of the insured, but you're saying it. You would read into that in a subjective standard?
I'm saying the courts do. And again, the Queen City Farms case expressly discusses this. It's a Supreme Court holding. It talks about the meaning of accident and expected or intended. And it says in that case they had a definition of expected or intended. And they said, well, they mentioned the case law defining accident. They said, we don't have that here. We don't have the term accident. That's not the issue here.
And there's no room for gradations of, well, a reasonable person may have expected bruising or some injury, but they wouldn't expect to break the jaw in three places. This specific injury, isn't there a question of fact about whether that's reasonably foreseeable?
Again, I refer you to the Safeco versus Dots case, Your Honor. That was something that, you know, you think might have gone the other way. A backhanded slap, a couple days later, the guy lapses into a coma and dies.
That's one of the oldest in the line of these cases, though.
It's good law, Your Honor. It's been cited many times. You know, you have the Butler case where the guy said he was trying to shoot at shoot to scare these kids who were knocking over his mailboxes, and there was a ricochet. You know, he didn't expect it, but you use an objective test, and based upon the experience that he had, anyone with that experience would have concluded that it was not an accident. It was not unexpected or unintended. Now, we could talk about the Hammond Rye case. These kids lit some paper in a dumpster on fire. If that's the end of it, and the grocery store burns down, you don't have an accident. You would have the Unigard case where the little boy lit a school on fire. But in that case, the kids took the burning paper out of the dumpster and thought they'd put it out, and then they left. And the grocery store burned down. There was an issue of fact as to accident. From a standpoint of a reasonable person, would a reasonable person think after they stopped on that, would it be unexpected or intended that the grocery store would burn down? The Hales case, this owner of the property watered some onions for an onion farmer, and he left the water on too long, and the onions rotted. Would the average purchaser of insurance, would a reasonable person think that watering the onions too long would cause them to rot? Well, I didn't know that until I read the case. And the court said no. So that's an accident. Well, I see my time is up. Thank you.
You did, however, have the opportunity to be the first person to actually discuss with us a piece of litigation that truly was a dumpster fire. So that was it'll be something I'll retain from today as time goes on.
As is clear from the arguments of both sides, the facts do matter in each individual case, and particularly as Judge Schindler and Judge Verlin have both pointed out, they're not defining this term in the policy. They're relying on case law. So you have to compare the facts as they're developed in the case law to the facts of this case, which, again, are not particularly well developed. I do note that the argument that this is merely an assertion in a declaration by Mr. Belt is somewhat undercut by the fact that the same assertion that Mr. Belt did not intend to injure Mr. Peters is also repeated in State Farm's own investigation report, and that was also submitted in response to summary judgment. So it's not simply a question of whether or not Mr. Belt stated this. State Farm's own investigator put this down in black and white on a piece of paper. And that, again, whether or not you want to believe Mr. Belt's sworn declaration or whether or not the trial court felt it was credible, this is also a statement on the record by State Farm, and that's a critical issue of material fact. The question of whether or not any reasonable person could possibly believe that you could not intend to injure someone by striking them, the same argument could be made for shooting a gun toward a moving car. The same argument could be made for whether you insert boar's tusks into your sleeping dental patient and to whether or not you would have injured that person psychologically, as happened in Wu. The same could be said for intentionally turning on a faucet and flooding a field. The same could be said for intentionally setting a dumpster fire and burning down a building as a result. The facts do matter. The facts are not well-developed in this case. Whether or not the policy burden is on the insured, this was State Farm's summary judgment motion. The facts were not sufficiently developed. There is a disputed issue of material fact, and summary judgment should be reversed, and this case should proceed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And with that, court is in recess.